Charles Dobbins grimaced as he felt the mood of the crowd around him shift. Somehow, this wasn't what he'd anticipated. This Carisian officer, Charles had no idea how to read the man's rank insignia, was supposed to be furious, screaming at them to disperse, threatening them, making his contempt for them clear. He certainly wasn't supposed to be just talking to them. And reasoning with them, or pretending he was at any rate, was just too underhanded and devious to be believed. And yet, Charles wasn't completely immune to the Carisian's manner. And the other man had a point about its being Wednesday. Not only that, but the Carisian's mention of his mother had reminded Charles forcibly of his own mother, and how she was likely to react when she found out what her darling boy had been up to when he was supposed to be at Mass himself. He didn't know what thoughts were going through the minds of the rest of the crowd, but he could sense the way the entire mob was settling back on its heels, losing the forward momentum which had carried it down the street. Some of the people in it, including some of Charles's friends, were still shouting, yet their voices had lost much of their fervor. They sounded shriller, more isolated, as if those voices' owners felt their own certainty oozing away. Charles took his hand away from the truncheon under his tunic and was a bit surprised to discover he was actually more relieved than regretful at the way things had so unexpectedly shifted. He started to turn away, then paused, his eyes widening in shock, as the man who'd just walked up behind him brought something out from under his own tunic. Charles had never seen one of the new flintlocks which had been introduced into the Coruscantian army, but he recognized what he had to be seeing now. It was a short, squat weapon, a musket whose stock had been cut down and whose barrel had been sawn down to no more than a couple of feet. It was still far bigger and clumsier than the pistols which equipped the Carisian Imperial Guard, and it must have been extraordinarily difficult to keep it hidden. But the flintlock, which had been fitted in place of its original matchlock, didn't need the clumsy, smoldering, impossible-to-hide lit slow match. That had probably helped a lot where concealing it was concerned, a corner of Charles's mind thought almost calmly. He watched, frozen, as the weapon rose. It poked over the shoulder of another young man, no more than a year or so older than Charles himself, standing beside him. The other young man twitched in astonishment, turning his head, looking across and down at the muzzle as it intruded into the corner of his field of vision, just as the man holding it squeezed the trigger. The sudden gunshot took everyone by surprise, even experienced non-coms like Waston and McGee. Perhaps it shouldn't have taken the sergeants unaware, but Tallis's obvious success in calming the crowd had lulled even them just a bit as well. The man behind that musket had marked the Marine lieutenant as his target. Fortunately for Brad Tallis, however, no one would ever have described the would-be murderer's weapon as a precision instrument. It was a smoothbore with a very short barrel and loaded with meal powder, not corned powder. Less than a quarter of the slow-burning, anemic propellant had actually been consumed before the rest was flung out of the barrel in a huge, blinding cloud, and the bullet's flight could only be characterized as erratic. The unfortunate young man who'd been looking at the muzzle at the moment it was fired screamed in agony as his face was savagely burned. He staggered back, clutching at his permanently blinded eyes, and four or five more people who'd been unlucky enough to be standing directly in front of him cried out in pain of their own as blazing flakes of gunpowder seared coal miners' tattoos into the backs of their necks. One especially luckless soul actually had his hair set on fire and went to his knees, howling in panic and pain as he beat at the flames with both hands. Charles Dobbins was far enough away to escape with only minor singeing, and his head snapped around, looking for the musket's target.
Shit!
Lieutenant Tallis wondered if Platoon Sergeant McGee even realized he'd spoken out loud. The single word was pitched almost conversationally, after all. Not that it was going to make a lot of difference. The musket ball had almost certainly been meant for him, the lieutenant realized, but it hadn't found him. Instead, it had slammed into the chest of one of his privates, a good 4 feet to his right. The Marine went down, clutching at the front of his suddenly bloody tunic, and Tallis realized something else. Major Porter's orders had been perfectly explicit on the matter of what Tallis was supposed to do if firearms or edged weapons were used against any of his troops. "Fix bayonets," he heard his own voice command, and the men of his platoon obeyed. He saw many of those in the crowd suddenly trying to back away as steel clicked and the long shining blades sprouted from the ends of his Marines' rifles. Some of them managed it, others found their escape blocked by the mass of bodies behind them, and still others reacted quite differently. Expressions snarled, truncheons and clubs came out from under tunics, and the front of the mob seemed to solidify somehow, drawing together. It seemed clear the people in those front ranks were ready for a fight. "For now," Brad Tallis thought grimly. "For now, perhaps." He looked at his bleeding private, and his jaw tightened as his expression hardened into something far less youthful than his years. He'd seen dead men enough at Talbert Pass. He looked away again, meeting McGee's eye, and his youthful voice was a thing of hammered iron. "Sergeant McGee, clear the street," he said.